Hello and welcome to Science World. News that the first case of Ebola has been diagnosed in the United States has raised fears here about the spread of the deadly virus. We'll tell you what U.S. health officials are doing to allay those fears. Science World's Doug Bernard checks in with a story about NASA's discovery of the strongest, hottest, and longest-lasting sequence of solar flares that have ever been seen. And we'll talk with Dr. Rob Garrett from Cornell University. Dr. Garrett, along with colleagues here in the United States and in Germany, have discovered an unusual carbon-based molecule some 27,000 light-years away. The researchers said that their discovery suggests that complex molecules, which are needed for life, may have originated way out in interstellar space. We'll have these stories and more for you on today's edition of VOA's Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. News that a Texas man was diagnosed with Ebola after returning home from Liberia has raised new concerns here about the spread of the disease. Public health officials here in the United States are working to reassure the medical workers and the American public. Carol Pearson has more.
The first Ebola patient to arrive in the United States flew on a plane specially equipped and designed to prevent the spread of the virus. That patient, Dr. Kent Brantley, entered Emory University Hospital through a special passage to the isolation unit. During a news conference outside the hospital, Dr. Jay Varkey reassured the public that they were not at risk.
I can't think of a better place in the world other than Emory University Hospital to care for this patient.
Some hospitals in developed countries have isolation units equipped with their own laboratories. Technicians do all the lab work right in the unit. And yet not every worker at Emory was comfortable with having an Ebola patient there.
Because a lot of the feedback we got from our staff was this perception was that this infection is a death sentence, that this infection can have 90, nearly 100% mortality rates.
Varkey and the hospital's other infectious disease experts met with staff members.
We had key leaders, so in both nursing and as well as the medical staff, infectious diseases who actually rounded in the hospital itself, from nursing station to nursing station, from unit to unit, to make ourselves available to answer questions.
Brantley eventually recovered, as did a second patient, Nancy Wrightball. Dr. Rick Sacra, the third Ebola patient flown to the U.S., was successfully treated at the University of Nebraska Hospital.
Though my crisis has reached a successful end here, unfortunately, the Ebola crisis continues to spin out of control.
Modern hospitals in developed countries are far different from the situation in Africa, where more than 240 medical workers have contracted Ebola in recent months. Most hospitals lack the supplies to contain the disease. In this Ebola holding facility in Sierra Leone, at least three employees have died of the virus. Nurses recently protested in Las Vegas, saying they are not trained to treat Ebola patients. Surveys show many Americans are afraid the Ebola virus might spread inside the U.S. Dr. Thomas Frieden, the director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, tried to tamp down concerns after a Texas hospital admitted an Ebola patient who had arrived last month from Liberia.
It's only spread by direct contact with someone who's sick with the virus, and it's only spread through body fluids.
Frieden says the Ebola virus is something to fear, but as more people get into treatment early, more people will survive. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
NASA said that one of its satellites found a neighboring mini-star rocking with an unusual series of solar activity. Science World's Doug Bernard tells us more.
NASA said this week that its Swift Gamma Ray Burst mission found earlier this year that a nearby red dwarf star shot out what they describe as the strongest, hottest, and longest-lasting sequence of solar flares ever recorded. A red dwarf is described as a small and relatively cool star, and is the most common star type in the cosmos. Stephen Drake from the Space Center's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland said that scientists used to think that episodes of major flaring from red dwarfs didn't last any longer than a day. But back this past April, SWIFT detected at least 7 powerful eruptions over a period of about 2 weeks. Scientists reported that the solar flare discharge from one of the pair of red dwarfs that make up the DGCVN binary star system began with what NASA called a, quote, record-setting series of explosions. The first blast of solar energy from the tiny star was found to be about 10,000 times more powerful than the largest solar flare ever recorded. Temperatures peaked at 200 million degrees Celsius, more than 12 times hotter than the center of our sun. NASA scientists said that the star took about 20 days to settle back down to its normal level of X-ray emissions after this series of powerful solar flares. For Science World, I'm Doug Bernard.
From floods to droughts to powerful storms, more people are impacted by extreme weather as the population increases. In Los Angeles, the Aquarium of the Pacific unveiled a tool to educate the public about extreme weather. Elizabeth Lee has this report.
Whether it's powerful hurricanes and typhoons or devastating droughts, extreme weather is no longer an unusual event, says meteorologist Mark Jackson, with the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, known as NOAA.
You know, extreme weather is the norm across the globe. There are certain things such as heat waves, such as droughts, and in some parts of the globe, heavy precipitation, that we are seeing an increase in these events.
And the weather outlook is not expected to improve, says Glenn McDonald, geography professor at the University of California, Los Angeles.
Places which are dry are probably going to get drier globally. Places which are already wet are probably going to get wetter. They're going to get the precipitation we're missing out on.
When it comes to hurricanes and typhoons, NOAA's Mark Jackson says, while the number of storms hasn't increased over the last half century, their intensity has. That trend is expected to continue.
The current projections are not that we might see an increase in number overall in the number of tropical systems, but an increase in the number of intense tropical systems.
But Glenn McDonald is cautious when talking about extreme weather because, he says, scientists only have about 150 years of climate observations on record.
In terms of attributing, in terms of general hurricane system, the general flood system, the general drought system, that precipitation events have become more extreme or something like that, I just don't think we have the statistics to show that generalization is true right now.
Scientists do agree devastating weather such as droughts and storms will continue to happen. They say reducing the production of greenhouse gases could help, but that takes time. In the meantime, a forecast that sees further than the current 14 days could help minimize the effects of extreme weather. Jackson says NOAA will be developing an extreme weather outlook that can predict events 15 to 30 days in advance.
It's very possible, and it's something that could be a very powerful tool to help us better adapt and be prepared for these extreme events.
Jerry Schubel of the Aquarium of the Pacific says the public needs to understand the seriousness of extreme weather.
Improved forecasts and longer warning times are of little value unless they are heeded.
From Europe to Asia, to North and South America, more than 100 museums and institutions around the world have installed a science on a sphere so people can better understand their environment, its challenges, and what can be done to adapt to a changing world. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
Coming up in a few minutes, we'll hear about the discovery of an unusual carbon-based molecule, a key ingredient for life on Earth, in deep interstellar space. There are 4 major types of carbon-based molecules found in all living things. Which of the following is not one of these 4 life-supporting molecules? Is it A, carbohydrates, B, lipids, C, proteins, D, water, or E, nucleic acids? Think about it and good luck. We'll give you the correct answer in just a few minutes from now. You're listening to Science World on VOA. You can also find us on the Internet. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science. The conservation group, the World Wildlife Fund, reports in its new Living Planet report that more than half of the world's wildlife population has been lost, risking the health of the planet. The WWF warns that urgent global action is needed to build a more sustainable future. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
WWF calls biodiversity a crucial part of the systems that sustain life on Earth. The scale of loss and damage to these ecosystems, it says, is alarming. The Living Planet report tracks over 10,000 vertebrate species populations from 1970 to 2010. The report says populations of fish, birds, mammals, amphibians, and reptiles have declined by 52% in just 40 years. It says freshwater species have fallen by 76%, an average loss almost double that of land and marine species. It says the majority of these losses are coming from tropical regions, with Latin America enduring the most dramatic drop. WWF International Director General Marco Lambertini tells VOA, habitat loss and unsustainable use are the two biggest threats to biodiversity.
This is about losing natural habitats. It's about converting forest, grasslands, and wetlands into agriculture mainly. And it is about unsustainable use of wildlife. So wildlife traffic, hunting, unsustainable hunting practices like that. Poaching, as you mentioned, has been actually increasing over the last 10 years and is definitely a driving force for extinction, particularly of large species. But also, as you mentioned, there are dimensions of poaching that are related to timber, illegal logging, and also fisheries.
The report also shows the world's ecological footprint, that is, the impact of human activities on the planet. The index measures human impact on the planet's resources in different ways. For example, Lambertini says people are breaking the thresholds of biodiversity loss, of carbon dioxide emissions, the dumping of nitrogen into oceans and rivers due to fertilizers in agriculture, and problems of ocean acidification.
So we are consuming on average every year about equivalent of about 1.5 times the resources available in the planet. That means we are cutting trees more quicker than they can be restored. We are fishing the oceans more quickly than fish stocks can reproduce. And we are emitting in the atmosphere more CO2 than the natural systems can actually absorb. This is clearly not sustainable.
WWF Director General Lambertini says the report highlights the importance of carbon footprint, which leads to climate change. He says this is not yet a major driver for biodiversity loss, but he warns climate change affects almost the whole global population, and it is projected to be the major force behind what could be a massive extinction wave of biodiversity if the world does not change direction. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
U.S. public health officials say at least four people have died after contracting a severe respiratory virus that has spread across the nation. Science World's Bob Doty has the rest of the story.
Officials at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said this Wednesday that it was unclear what role the enterovirus played in these fatalities, which included a 10-year-old girl who died last week in Rhode Island. Officials are also investigating a possible link of the virus with small children in Denver, Colorado, who have suffered paralysis or muscle weakness. The CDC said at least 500 people in 42 states and the District of Columbia have been sickened by the EVD68 virus, many of them children. EVD68 is a commonly occurring virus, but health officials say the number of confirmed cases this year is higher than normal. The virus causes fever, coughing, and other symptoms, and can lead to severe breathing troubles, especially among people who suffer from asthma. For Science World, I'm Bob Doty.
According to the World Wildlife Fund, the North American monarch butterfly is in trouble. Its population has dropped dramatically and is in danger of disappearing. Roseanne Skirbel reports.
While the monarch butterfly is famous for its annual migration across North America to Mexico, some species don't migrate at all, says study co-author Marcus Kromforst, an assistant professor in the Department of Ecology and Evolution at the University of Chicago.
Actually, in the tip of Florida, so in extreme southern Florida, there's non-migratory monarchs, but then there's also non-migratory monarch butterflies in South and Central America, across the Pacific, across the Atlantic, in Spain, Portugal, and in North Africa.
The study compares genomes of 100 monarch species. What researchers had expected, that the butterfly originated as a non-migratory species in tropical South America, came north, and then evolved migration, was not what they saw in the genetic data.
We found that the North American populations appear to be the ancestral populations and that the butterfly was probably ancestrally migratory. And then it dispersed out of North America into South and Central America and lost migration. And then it also independently dispersed across the Pacific and lost migration. And then independently a third time dispersed across the Atlantic and lost migration.
A monarch family tree created from the genomic analysis tells the age of the different populations and how they were related to each other over evolutionary time.
And so the populations that come out at the base of the tree, that tells us something that those are sort of the older population. The populations that come out towards the tips of the tree are the younger population.
So the North American migrant is at the base of the tree. As the researchers looked for genetic change across species to locate where and when migration stopped, Kromforst says one gene stood out.
Basically, in this one gene, a collagen gene, all three times that the butterflies left North America and lost migration, they changed at this one gene in exactly the same way.
Kromforst says that gene is related to the monarch's flight muscles.
And it looks like what we're seeing is that the North American migratory butterflies are just very efficient in how they fly. They have enhanced flight muscle efficiency, whereas the non-migratory butterflies appear to be pushed in the opposite direction by natural selection. They appear to be flying fast and hard.
In scanning the genomic data, the researchers also identified a single gene associated with the butterfly's signature orange color. Kronforst expects future studies will yield more discoveries about the iconic monarch, whose migration has filled North American skies for millions of years. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
Let's see if you have the correct answer to this week's Science World Quick Quiz. There are four major types of carbon-based molecules found in all living things on Earth. Which of the following is not one of these four life-supporting molecules? Is it A, carbohydrates, B, lipids, C, proteins, D, water, or E, nucleic acids? The answer is D, water. Choices A, B, C, and E are the four major types of carbon-based molecules that are found in Earth's living things. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
You're listening to Science World, VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine.
U.S. and German astronomers using the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array, or ALMA, located in northern Chile, found an unusual carbon-based molecule in a gas cloud some 20,000 light-years away. Now, what makes this molecule unusual is its structure. Other carbon-based or organic molecules that have been found in star-forming areas of space have its carbon atoms arranged in a single straight chain. But this newly discovered molecule has a more complex, branched structure. Those involved with the research behind the discovery said that their finding suggests that complex molecules needed for life may have originated out in interstellar space. Dr. Rob Garrod from Cornell University's Center for Radiophysics and Space Research was a member of the research team. He joins us today for our one-on-one segment to talk about the discovery of this highly unusual deep space molecule. Dr. Garrod, what is this unusual carbon-based molecule?
It's something called isopropyl cyanide. And what's special about it, for one thing, is that it's jointly the largest molecule that we've found in a region where stars are forming out in space. But what's really exciting about it is its underlying chemical structure. All of the molecules that we have detected in these regions where stars are forming, the backbone, if you like, of those molecules is made of carbon. And those carbon atoms are arranged in an essentially straight chain. Now, the difference with the molecule that we detected here is that it has a branched structure. So this carbon backbone splits off kind of a Y shape. What's important about this, though, is that this is a new structure for molecules in space. And we think that detecting this molecule in particular will sort of serve as a new frontier in the degree of complexity that we can find for molecules in space.
Is it common to find organic or carbon-based molecules out in space?
A large proportion, in fact, probably the majority of molecules that we detect in space do have carbon in them. In fact, the molecule that we detect most commonly is carbon monoxide. And of course, that has one carbon atom in it. But there are quite a number of larger carbon-bearing molecules that are detectable in space, certainly.
I've heard the old saying, and perhaps you've heard it too, looking for a needle in a haystack. But when you're able to pick up on something as small as a molecule from 27,000 light years away, how were you and your group able to do this?
We're not detecting a single molecule. What we're detecting is a large number of the same molecule in a very large region of space. But nevertheless, as you say, it is something like a needle in a haystack. What we do is we point radio telescopes towards these regions of space where stars are forming. So these are radio dishes with radio receivers mounted on them. And what we find is we get radio signals from molecules. And those radio signals are very specific frequencies. So particular molecules, depending on how complex they are, we may detect dozens or perhaps hundreds of emission frequencies from those molecules. But what's special about that is the frequencies which we detect those radio waves are very specific to each molecule. So when you see a particular pattern of frequencies, you can identify it with a known molecule. The difficulty, of course, is that these regions of space have so many different kinds of molecules all emitting at different frequencies, that very often these sort of molecular fingerprints that we look for can get smeared out. They overlap each other, and we have to kind of tease out one molecule's emission from another's.
Where was this molecule found?
So it was found in a region very close to the center of the galaxy called Sagittarius B2. It's about 27,000 light years away, so the light that we detect, the radio waves that we detect from these molecules, that has actually taken about 27,000 years to reach us from the center of the galaxy. But this region is actually very well known for being particularly rich in complex organic molecules, organic meaning carbon-bearing molecules. And it's also very rich in star formation regions. That's why we're so interested in looking for these complex molecules in space, is because we think that eventually these molecules that are formed in space will eventually be incorporated into new planetary systems and may ultimately be delivered to the surfaces of planets, which presumably could impact the sort of ultimate emergence of life on those planets.
Were you and your team intentionally looking for carbon molecules?
You could say we had a list of target molecules that we thought might be there, but which hadn't been detected yet. We had a reasonable idea that the molecule that we actually found would be out there. What surprised us, I think, was the abundance of this molecule. So it's almost as abundant as its straight chain sister molecule. And that's very positive news if we're interested in finding other branched molecules. It suggests that this branched chemical structure is not just a fluke. It may actually be the rule rather than the exception for interstellar molecules.
That was Dr. Rob Garrod from the Center for Radiophysics and Space Research at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. That's it for this edition of Science World. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I am Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.